Next Chapter Podcasts.
Hi, my name is Michael Goodfriend, and I'm the executive producer of the Play On Podcasts. Dorcas Lung is with me. She is an actress from New York who plays Juliet in the Play On Podcast series, Romeo and Juliet, and she's agreed to be part of our bonus content interview series for this Play On Podcast series. She describes herself as a left-handed actress based in New York. She got her start singing at church and in choir, but it wasn't until following a crush led her to audition for her first musical in middle school. Since then, she's gone on to perform in Broadway's Miss Saigon, Off-Broadway's Midsummer, the first national tour of Hamilton as Eliza, Angelica, Peggy, and Maria, and The Tale of Despereau and Les Miserables. She played Cosette regionally. Her television credits include CBS's Bull and Madam Secretary, and she appeared in the 2012 film Bindle Stiffs. It is my pleasure to welcome Dorcas Lung to this interview. Dorcas, hello.
Hi. How did you know all that?
Well, I will say that our intrepid producer, Pete Musto, does our guest research, and he puts together these little biographies. So somehow he got that from whatever was online. Isn't that interesting?
Wow, the internet.
Yes, the internet reports everything, even things we don't know about ourselves. Okay, Dorcas, so you are left-handed. Let's get the facts straight.
Yeah. Yes, right. That is true.
How has that helped you in your career?
Being left-handed is definitely something I think that other left-handers point out to you all the time. If you see somebody in rehearsal that's also left-handed, everyone's so quick to be like, me too. So I think it's a very nice biological bonding moment for people. And then, you know, the rumors are true. I think a lot of left-handers are very creative, have lots of interest in probably the arts and performance. So yeah, lots of us here.
Well, we have that in common. I am also left-handed.
Awesome.
Yes. And I agree. It's a great conversation starter. And, you know, we do see the world a little bit differently because so many people are right-handed.
That's true.
But I think that the left versus right is kind of getting more and more dissipated as technology keeps taking leaps beyond our collective abilities.
It's true. Yeah. I like remember, you know, growing up, people being like, do you need left-handed scissors? And right. I think I've always grown up using right-handed scissors just because I was like, oh, this is what's available to me at the moment. But like, you know, everyone kind of technology in general has elevated so that everything feels like more equal footing. So yeah, I don't feel like it's ever really hindered me.
And was it a crush that really did lead you to become an actor?
It was a crush. He is my best friend still. And he wanted to do Music Man in middle school. So I was like, well, if Patrick's going to do it, I definitely want to spend more time with him. Patrick is not interested in women. So now at this point, you know, our hopes and dreams of being together forever romantically are not necessarily going to happen. But best friends forever.
When did you discover Shakespeare? Has Shakespeare always been a part of your work as an actor?
So I have a very strong musical theater background. So I do a lot of contemporary, classic, traditional musical theater. Over the pandemic, my husband, we met in school, and he was also a classical actor mostly. So while I was a musical theater actor, he's a classical actor, we both do similar things, but in very different veins. And over the pandemic, he was taking an online class with Ron Daniels, who has been one of the artistic directors at the RSC, is also just a phenomenal Shakespeare teacher. And Ron was offering these incredible classes for, you know, 4 weeks to 6 weeks at a time. And you would work on different pieces in kind of a salon setting. So you would have other people with you giving you feedback, also saying like, oh, this is what I heard when you did it this time. So Oliver, my husband, would be doing them in our other room, and I would like kind of sneak in and hear and be like, oh, that's really interesting. Because I took Shakespeare in college, but it wasn't something that I personally was like, oh, I want to pursue full-heartedly, I suppose. So during the pandemic, after like, you know, Oliver would tell me all these amazing things he learned in class, I was like, you know, I should sign up for this. Like, I want to get out of my comfort zone and work with text and, you know, maybe revisit something that I don't necessarily feel great at, and like it would be so outside of what I usually do. So like, why don't I do that? So I signed up for a class with Ron, and the morning of our first session, we were scheduled to be together for a month. He let me know that every single person in the class had just somehow canceled and weren't able to take the class for the next month. Life happens, you know. Yeah. So I ended up having private one-on-one sessions with Ron for every Saturday for the next month. And we worked on Juliet, which is like wow. Such a, you know, circular story, I suppose. And yeah, it was so fun and so like logic puzzle. Like I love puzzles and I love to like figure out like, okay, so if I use this word here, what does it do to the rest of the sentence? Mm-hmm. I think there were some benefits in me not having maybe the most training in terms of doing Shakespeare, because I didn't think I had very many rules to follow. So I just didn't follow any rules. I just said the things that they felt like they meant to me in that moment. And in that, I found that I was really also like so pleasantly surprised at how much of it equated to my musical theater training, because it's so musical. And so like, how do I make these phrases sound like one whole thing? And then how do I chop up the next thing for you to really feel like the same way you would feel a phrase of music? So yeah, I think Shakespeare in a lot of ways is like, you know, when you're like a dancer, ballet is like your fundamentals, your like technique fundamentals. And like, yeah. I've always loved ballet, even though I'm not an amazing dancer by any means, but it's always felt like logically, satisfying to me. And I think Shakespeare in the same way feels that way. It's like, these are the fundamentals, these are the techniques you can use to also like do so many other things in your career. So yeah, it's been really fun to do.
You started out singing, is that mm-hmm. right? So singing was your first love?
Yes, for sure.
Where did you discover that you loved singing? How did you discover it?
How? Like these memories. I was talking to my friends about this last week, of having like singing sing-offs on the playground and like, you know, having another kid with me on the playground and being like, okay, let's choose this song. It's going to be, the 18s were super popular when I was growing up. Like we'll sing this and then we'll have everyone around us vote. So it's like playground idol basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I loved doing that and I loved to sing and I still love to sing. So I started doing that. And then, my dad was the pastor at our church. So one of the things that I got to do was like sing on Sundays. Oh. They'd be like, Dorcas is the soloist this week. And then, you know, up until middle school, like I said, I did choir. And then middle school is the first time I was able to do a musical because they offered it. And so seventh grade was my first musical and it was The Music Man.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And then did you do musicals only in school, middle school and high school, or did you start doing community theater? Did you start doing any professional theater as a kid?
Yeah, so I was really lucky in that my public school was very serious about musical theater. I don't know how that happened. I mean, I grew up in Texas, so football is a big thing, and they got plenty of support too. But amazingly enough, like our high school theater department was really, really supported. We did two big musicals a year, plus a smattering of plays during the year. We had a black box theater. I think there's like, you know, funding is obviously like a big part of being able to do public school theater. And we were just very lucky to be able to have the funding to do it. Because it was all free. Like, I don't think I would be able to do what I do today if I was not able to have the support, financial support from my community to be able to do it. Because like dance lessons, acting lessons, like music, voice lessons are expensive. So mm-hmm. being able to be supported like that and like have that community and be so like I was in it. So theater at my high school, like before the year would start, 2 weeks before the school year would start, we would have like a staging and blocking and dance rehearsal for 2 weeks straight. So I would be at school from 9 to 6 in August before school started in preparation for the winter musical. But like, you know, that was theater boot camp for me and I loved it. I made so many memories and I also learned like discipline. I learned how to treat others, whatever role you're playing, how you're involved with the production. I learned how to sign in. Like, you know, there are these like little things that you kind of don't think about that also go with the art itself. And I was able to like have a safe space to learn how to do it before I went into the real world.
Signing in, meaning like literally initialing the sheet when you go into rehearsal?
Exactly. Yeah. Like being able to go to a call board where like, you know, all the information of the day is held, letting you know, this is like what we're running today. Right. This is who's needed today. And then like doing the responsibility of signing myself in to say like, hey, I'm here.
Right. You know, which is important. Like, otherwise the casting, I'm sorry, not the casting director, but the stage manager needs to know that you're there somewhere in the building, because if you're not, they need to find you or they need to plan around you.
Yeah, right? It's true. Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually pretty essential. And you find out really quickly in professional theater what happens if you don't sign it.
Yes, you do.
There's hazing, and then there are literal fines that start getting levied by the union.
Yeah, it's true.
So, okay. Did you do formal training after you graduated from high school when you went into college? Did you major in theater?
So I went to the University of Oklahoma. I grew up in Houston, so Oklahoma's a quick 8-hour drive away.
Mm-hmm. And quick for Texas.
Exactly. I majored in musical theater. I got my BFA there. And Oklahoma was great. I think that I wanted a school, you know, I'm not necessarily like a huge sports fan, but I wanted like the collegiate experience. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to go somewhere where I would meet people that weren't theater majors. I wanted to take classes that weren't necessarily necessary for my major. And I wanted like a quad. I wanted to be able to ride my bike up and down South Oval, things like that. So, yeah.
So you went to University of Oklahoma, you got your BFA, and then you were like, that's it, I'm ready, I'm going to go to New York.
Yeah, so my program, luckily enough, does a showcase. We showcased in New York my senior year of college. And then right after that, I was like, I think I'm ready to move. I'm going to take the next step and move. Packed my bags, 2 suitcases that equaled exactly 50 pounds, and then got to New York. Yeah.
And did you have an agent at that point because of the showcase?
I did. I was fortunate that my agents had signed me through like word of mouth. I had lots of friends that had recommended me. So it was nice. And when we met, it was like it was a great match at that time. So it was, I feel fortunate in that way that I was able to like move here and be able to start working almost immediately.
And now you are on Broadway.
Yeah, I'm about to be again. Yeah.
What number of shows will this be for Broadway for you?
This will be my second, but okay. I will be accomplishing a goal of mine, which I'm really excited, which is to originate on Broadway. This has been like one of my 5 to 10 year goals. So that's exciting.
And what are you originating as in?
Oh yeah. So I'm coming back to Broadway in The Notebook, the musical, which is written by Becca Brunstetter and Ingrid Michaelson. And I will be originating a role that they wrote for the show. Her name's Georgie. If you know, listeners, The Notebook is this famous love story between Noah and Allie, if you've seen the movie, and the character is written as be one of Noah's best friends.
And this character was not in the movie.
Mm-mm, nope.
They wrote it specifically for you to play.
I don't know about specifically for me, but specifically
like,
for
how can
show.
We get Dorcas Lung into this?
If only everyone thought that way.
Well, that's just wonderful. Congratulations. When do you
Thanks.
Open?
Thanks. We open next year, February. We start previews, and then official opening is in March 2024.
So how did you meet or get to know Dustin Wills, the director of the Play On podcast series of Romeo and Juliet, and Hansel mm-hmm. Young, who did the translation?
Yeah, so I auditioned. I met Hansel at closing night of K-Pop the Musical, which closed last year. And I had heard she was doing this translation of the play, and bravery struck me. And I said, hey, I'd really like to be in this play. And so she said, you need to audition. Great. So I sent in a tape near last year. And this was for the production that was a co-pro between Two River Theater in Red Bank, New Jersey, and NatCo, which is helmed by Mia, who is the nurse in our production. But I sent in a video last winter, and they needed more information after that. And when they asked me, my agents called me and said, hey, they want you to do another take of this. I was like, that's great. I'm in Hong Kong right now seeing family. So how do you want this to happen? They were like, we'll just do it as soon as possible. So I was like, all right. So I'm with family being like, where can I find a quiet place to tape this? I rented a room in a family friend's like apartment building. They had like amenity section and they were like, you can rent this room. I was like, okay, great. So I went in there. There's some pretty crazy wallpaper in my video too, but did the video and then left for dim sum right after. Yeah.
Wow. Our interconnected world really makes incredible things possible.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
You know, the Play On podcasts originated during the pandemic and nobody could be in a studio together because we couldn't breathe the same air without risking our lives. So we had to send kits to all of the actors to record remotely from just the type of rooms you're describing, closets in their own apartments or in friends' apartments or in hotels, wherever they happen to be, and padding up the rooms and making them soundproof and turning them into basically remote studios.
Right.
You know, and all of this was made possible because of the internet and some of the technology that's available today, which is pretty extraordinary.
You know, like when we were doing pickups 2 weeks ago, Sada just kind of like, who is one of our audio engineers, like kind of slipped in. He was like, he was like, I'm in Tokyo. And like, I didn't really like process that until the end of the session. I was like, Sada, you're in Tokyo. And he was like, yeah, it's 4 a.m. here. And I was like, oh no. And you're listening to us make bird sounds, you know? Yeah.
Very surreal experiences. So you got the part and you did the production in first in New Jersey or NATCO, which is an acronym, NAATCO, for National Asian American Theater Company. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Did the original staging happen at Two River Theater in New Jersey or was it at a different theater?
It was. It was at Two River first.
Two River. And then it went to New York.
Yes, that's right. We were off Broadway at the Lynn J. G. Angelson is the theater's name.
Which is where I saw you in the production that I was so fortunate to get to watch. How was the experience of the podcast different from the stage version? I mean, apart from the obvious, right? You're not interacting directly, but what was that like going from stage, having those physical relationships and then converting into this audio only medium?
Yeah. I mean, even the difference between the Two River production to the Downtown New York production to the podcasts are vast. I think the biggest thing is that our production is extremely physical. So there's a lot of physical gags, sight gags. There are, you know, physical humor, you know, we're throwing ourselves all over that stage. Everyone had knee pads on. So the question of how do we still make these things not only funny, but also like clear was really, really, I think, a specific challenge to do in the podcast version. It's also really hard not to see each other, to be in these booths and not be able to like relate. Again, like our production was very, very relational. It was very like about the person seeing the other person and saying the words to each other. And so it was interesting to just like be able to only rely on the text and not necessarily the physical body. I think that's a really big part of it. Another part is that our production is very reliant on audience reaction. So a lot of it was breaking the fourth wall and looking directly into the audience and giving all of our monologues to the audience, seeing how they responded and having that response fuel the rest of the monologue. And not having the audience as my audience, made just for different reads, made for different ways of speaking the text and relating again.
Join Play On Premium to get merch like t-shirts, hoodies, and coffee mugs, ad-free episodes, and bonus content video featuring interviews with the actors, producers, playwrights, and directors who brought it all to life. Go to ncpodcasts.com and subscribe to Play On Premium to support the art and the artists.
When you did the recordings, did you feel like the previous experiences hindered that transition, or did it help for your performance? Do you wish is there a part of you that wishes you could have come to it through audio only without the theater experience, or did you find it useful ultimately?
I think they're so different. It's really hard to even say. I definitely don't think it hindered. It felt like it was almost like another, we created another subsect of what we have created as Romeo and Juliet, this version. So it just mm-hmm. feels like another, it's like a baby of our other version. So it doesn't feel like it hindered. It's just a completely different thing.
And you had a different Romeo when we did the podcast.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Major Curda, who played Romeo in the stage production, was unavailable because he was doing a film. So the role was recast. We got the incredible Chris Bano to work with you and the rest of the cast.
Mm-hmm.
Tough transition for you?
Chris is exciting. So easy to fall in love with. So no, not a tough transition at all. It was really great working with like all the new people that we had into, like Mitch Winter was also new. Dice was new as my new father.
Dice Kate Suji, nice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's Romeo and Juliet as a piece in general is universal in so many ways. And it was nice to have them come and be like welcomed in this like very zany version of it. So yeah. I hope they had fun. We had fun with them.
It definitely sounds like you had fun as we're going through all of the audio and doing the mixes. It sounds terrific. So what did you discover about Juliet? You've had such an incredible journey with her in just a short amount of time, starting with Ron Daniels, then meeting Hansel and becoming a part of the Two River Gnat co-production and then into the podcast.
Yeah.
Who is Juliet?
Ugh, who is she? There's so much to say. I've had the great, great fortune of being able to play Juliet for the better part of this year, and I still feel like I have so much more to go into. I think something that really sticks with me with this production in particular is how alone she feels in a very male-dominated world with, you know, there's no, her only worth is marriage. And what a disappointment for someone who's so bright, who is so beautiful, intelligent, able to talk her way through any situation, logical. Like, there are so many things about her that are not explored, I think, in every production, because Romeo and Juliet sometimes is taken as just kind of like the everlasting love story. And so there are a lot of things about Juliet that I feel like sometimes I'm like, I wish she had her own play, because like there's just so much going on there. I think it's like a gift, obviously, to play a female character who has strength and has like, she wants to make her own decisions, but I think the world around her does not allow her to because of just the rules that are already put there. Her age, her sex, you know, all of it is just like working against her, even with her hardest tries. I'm also really stricken by how funny and like witty she is. Just her wordplay is like unmatched. And the way that she chooses to use her wordplay, like, you know, in the first scenes when she's with her mom, she's like, I'll give you 5 words, nothing more. Cause like, I don't think it's worth it. Why waste my precious breath on you when you're not going to understand my wordplay? But when she's with the nurse, it's like, brrr, like she's like able to just like play and like, and tease her and work through that. And then meeting Romeo, having someone get you, not only like your good wordplay, but your bad stuff too. It's like, oh, that's so awesome. Like you can see me as dorky and weird as I am and you still love me. Like that's amazing. And you can match me, you challenge me. That's just so exciting.
How is she similar to you?
Independent, logical, extremely logical. Fear of showing emotion too much. I think she's, you know, I think that there's like a lot of her wanting to make something larger of herself sometimes in a space that doesn't always allow her to, that I do also it resounds with me. Like I feel that too.
You mentioned that you were in Hong Kong visiting family when you got your call back to do the stage production with Hansel and Dustin. Is your whole family from Hong Kong?
Yeah, so my mom and my dad and I immigrated when I was a kid because my dad went to seminary. So he was called to move to the States to go to seminary. So just the three of us came over. But my entire family, like my dad's siblings, my mom's relatives, everybody's in Hong Kong.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So your father and mother were the first of their families to come to America?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how old were you?
I was three when I came over.
Do you have any memory at all, any deep-seated memory of being in Hong Kong
as a child? Like I remember some, you know, playing at our old townhouse and stuff, but you know, some of my like youngest memories, like I remember specifically when we immigrated, the first place we went was to a Walmart to get, you know, things. And I was really excited because the comforter I wanted had a giant Mickey Mouse on it. So I was very excited about that. And like, I remember being at the checkout line and getting that. I think I'm lucky enough too that we've been able to go back with some frequency, not as much as like I would love to, but I've been able to go back in kind of like my formative years, like in elementary school, and then back again when I was like hitting puberty in middle school. So you got some really great pictures from that time. And then high school, college, and then like post-marriage, I had like my second wedding celebration there too with our family. And that was really nice. Mm-hmm.
Are you bilingual?
I am. I speak Cantonese.
Wow. And have you found a way to incorporate that into any of your work as an actor?
You know, the way that I look is always going to be the, you know, being an Asian representation, even to have people come see me on stage is powerful enough, I think, in some ways. I have not been able to speak Chinese in any of the work I've done, though, which is interesting. I think Mandarin is more commonly spoken. So a lot more people do ask for Mandarin to be spoken in plays or TV film. But yeah, it was really, really fun to do. I like honestly, in the best way, forget that our production was all Asian people because it wasn't focused on like, I talked to Mia about this too. Like we weren't going to do Romeo and Juliet and everyone's wearing kimonos. Like there was no point in doing that. It's just a story. And like having these actors be able to tell them and also to see like, oh, these are all Asian actors. I really do think, you know, we hear it all the time, but representation does matter because you're able to see, you know, an Asian woman play Juliet and you're able to see an Asian man play Paris Tybalt. Like, you know, these are things that are so widely on the human spectrum in terms of thoughts and feelings and intentions. And like, yeah, Asian people obviously have all of those thoughts and feelings and intentions as well. So yeah, being part of an all Asian cast of this, kind of take it for granted sometimes because I'm kind of just like, yeah, it was an amazing production. And that's why it was amazing. Not only because we were all Asian too.
Did your parents get to New York or New Jersey to see you?
Mm-hmm. My mom saw it in New York. Yeah. She loved it. Right.
A lot of theater artists that I've spoken to and worked with over the years have come from some type of theological background, whether their family, I mean, there are many, many actors and writers, especially that I know who either majored in theology or came from families that were just steeped in religion. You know, Marcus Gardley comes to mind, who did our translation of King Lear. And I just find it so fascinating how many people seem to have this sort of background or basis in not just in a religious identity, but really being involved, you know, in the choir of the church like you were, or having a parent who is part of the clergy.
Yeah.
Do you find that you draw on it as an artist in any way? Or that you react to it as an artist?
I think I definitely react to it. I mean, it's like so ingrained in a part of who I am. You know, even like not being a regular attendee of the church, like church is very theatrical. Going to a service is very theatrical. There's an overture. There's an act one and an act two, and then we end with the benediction. You know, there's a lot going on there that I think that feels comforting to me. I just saw two different pieces come to mind when I think about religion and theater. The Christians at Play Arts Horizons, like I saw that a couple years ago, and just seeing the pulpit and seeing the choir, and like, you know, there's a part of me that's like, oh, I recognize this like to my core. And then I just saw Pray. Ars Nova did this amazing piece that centers on femmes in the church, and Black femmes specifically, and how so much of the church has been so integral in giving Black femmes a voice, especially in times of like slavery. Like, the church lets women and femmes know, like, you do have a place because you mother, you also lead, you also are a part of the church in so many different ways. And I think that was just such a different way to look at religion and church in general, because you think of it being such a patriarchal led institution. But yeah, like, religion has always influenced me. Church influences me. I think it's very interesting. Belief sways so many things that happen in our world, obviously. So yeah, it does. And also historically, like, you can see how much, as the church changes, how does that change the history of how people react to certain things as well. So yeah, I do think it affects me as an artist.
It's so interesting also with Shakespeare, because Shakespeare was, you know, religion was a life or death identifier in his time, and how Shakespeare tries to thread the needle between Protestants, Catholics, and, you know, all of the iterations of the people's identity, trying to serve the monarchy, trying to serve Queen Elizabeth, and be political with references to religion. And how much religion played a role in his own education.
For sure.
And how that came through in his work and his humanism. I'm never able to really find, you know, if Shakespeare had a loyalty to any religion or the other, but I know that, you know, there's a great book, Will in the World, that talks about how his family would have been and was, they were treated very unfairly because of their identity, I believe, as Catholics. I'll have to do fact checking on it.
I'd be curious about Will in the World. Is that just basically talking about his, like, his life within his personal life and his, like, his beliefs and such?
Yeah. Just what was going on in his world when he was alive and writing.
Yeah.
And literally the life or death of in the choices that he made as a writer, and in just in places that he chose to live or travel.
When you're talking about religion too, I'm thinking about, just tying it all back, Juliet, as she is extremely religious and cares deeply about making a vow. Vows are holy, like being able to have these promises and being able to, like, be married in the church. And to, you know, she goes through so much turmoil in terms of, like, I have made a vow. If I let that go, I will be, of course, like, I will, but it's worse than death, because I will be going to hell, like, if I do not continue my truth is so integral to who she is. And, like, that was something I thought was pretty amazing for somebody that, like, is depicted a lot as kind of a teenager sneaking around. So many of the things that she does are based on holy values, and not just kind of like frivolity. So serious for a 13-year-old.
Where do you think Juliet sees the truth of her parents?
What do you mean?
Well, she rejects them.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like she makes that choice in the story itself. Like, she's almost there, and then she pretty much revolts against them. I mean, that's at least how how it comes across to me. What do you think it is in Lord and Lady Capulet that she sees that she chooses to reject?
In this version, it feels like their marriage is a marriage of convenience. She doesn't see true love between the two of them. And also that they treat her like an object to be able to be sold immediately. There's no thought process about like her wants, her needs. And I think that when she meets Romeo, she finally sees somebody that, like, sees her and wants her as a whole being to be loved and to be cherished and to be wanted. And so, yeah, I just think that, like, her parents, although they may have the best of intentions of what works for their world, I don't think that they treat her well. I mean, it's a very different thing that, you know, modern day, obviously, like, that is how we feel. Back then, they had political gain. They had financial gain. There's so many other things and aspects that they're thinking of as they're making these kind of deals with Paris in particular. But yeah, I think that the only person at that home that sees her is the nurse, until the nurse tells her to, I think it's best that you marry with Paris. Then she's mm-hmm. like, I have nobody. Nobody is actually looking out for my heart or what I want or my happiness. Everyone looks bigger picture outside of her.
Yeah, the nurse basically departs from the path of honesty and truthfulness with Juliet.
For sure.
At least in the way that Juliet perceives it.
And I think that Juliet is raised on honesty and truth because the nurse is the one who's taught it to her. She has always been the one to say, you know, these are the ways that I want you to live your life. Like, I think her only true parent is the nurse. And for her to go against everything she's ever taught her, I mean, yeah, it is the biggest heartbreak.
So Romeo sees mm-hmm. Juliet for who she truly is.
I think he does. And I think he also, even if he's learning who she is, I think he gives her space to be who she is. I don't think he puts her in some sort of metaphorical box the way that I think other people do. I think he's amazed by her, and I think he wants more of that. And so he gives her the space to be able to be herself and to feel the vulnerability with him and to dream. I don't think that she had ever thought before meeting him that she could dream bigger than what was going to be prescribed to her.
And what is it about Romeo himself that she loves besides how he sees her?
Yeah, I think vulnerability is a big part of it. Like, his ability to make the worst rhymes and to be so embarrassing and to be bold. You know, he shows up knowing that death is on the way and he still does this dramatic big act of love. And you know, she logically, the first thing she thinks is like, you have to go, you cannot be here. But there's that little tiny thing in the back of her mind. It's like, he's here. Like, that's so wonderful. You know, no one's ever done that for me. These kind of extreme acts of love that just kind of, I mean, she, at the heart of it, she is a teenage girl. Like, she, it's like, this is like the best, most exciting thing ever. But also, you have to go. Like, this is not safe. I think he's not like anyone she's known, because even though he does come from the same kind of, maybe a little less financial level than her, like, she's used to these kind of stuffy dudes that are like, I have nothing to talk to you about. You're boring me. And then here comes this guy that's like goofy and odd and romantic and all these things that I don't think so that she, I think he represents something, again, that is outside the world that she's been prescribed, which is, you are going to marry somebody of the same financial status. You will look exactly like your mom. You will live within those castle walls instead, versus Romeo perhaps offers something that is more akin to like a good meal and a good song and being able to travel and being able to see the world for the first time. I don't think that she really even dreamed, even if she had read it in a book, I don't think she actually thought she could actually see the world ever. And I think he offers that to her.
He is freedom. Yeah.
Yes, he is freedom. That's true.
And the two of them, I mean, is it fair to say that they die for the truth?
Absolutely. I think the death is success. I mean, that wasn't plan A, but mm-hmm. I think that at the end of it, if I can't have him, what's freedom anyways, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember when we were working on this in the podcast, the idea that her last lines, instead of being out of desperation and fear, when she realizes people are coming to the graveyard, she's hearing noises and she's looking around for the dagger. It's almost like, instead of this fear and I have to get out of here because I don't want to get caught, it's relief. It's, oh, I remember the poison didn't work, but the dagger is here. I still have this chance for freedom with my one true love, and this is my happy ending. Which I do think is a different maybe interpretation of that, but it's true. I think that, like you said, they die for freedom and for truth and for the honesty of their relationship together. So a lot of it I do think is kind of a relief at the very end.
You worked, as you said, with Ron Daniels mm-hmm. on this role using the original text of Shakespeare, I assume.
Yes.
How was it going from that to Hansel's translation? And what worked for you, what didn't work for you in that transition from working on Shakespeare's original text to this translation?
So with Hansel's translation, I believe I'm correct in this, but the premise of what Play On did was to make this play like how Elizabethans would have heard it in their time, but for our time. Mm-hmm. So Hansel still stuck with the iamb within the play. So we still are going within iambic pentameter. And I think the thing that does work a lot more is that when you hear things, you have a more immediacy to it versus, I think sometimes in the original, there are times where I have to be like, what does that mean? Not to say that, you know, Hansel, sometimes I am like, what does that mean? But there is something more colloquial with the translation, and just for the modern ear, you just have a quicker understanding of the meaning of these words. I don't think that one thing works better than the other. I think that translations are always going to happen. You know, I think there's always like kind of the conversation of like, does it need to be translated? The original's the original for a reason. And the original will always be the original. It will always stay. But like, how amazing is it that Shakespeare has inspired so many different translations so that so many more people can understand it? I don't think it doesn't hurt the original. I think it only helps people to have more access to it, if anything else. Because again, like Shakespeare for me, even to go see my husband perform it, sometimes I was like, what is going on? Like, I'm not sure I have the prerequisite knowledge for this, because there is a lot of reliance on history knowledge and religious knowledge. So sometimes watch some of the plays specifically about the wars, I am like, what's going on here? But being able to do translations, I think, just gives this work in general a broader audience. And I think that's a win for everybody. Because if more people are able to understand it, we're not like gatekeeping Shakespeare, you know? So like, people have the ability to enjoy something that maybe seemed daunting for them to enjoy before. Because I think that is a big part of it. Like, Shakespeare sometimes feels like, it's like, because it is, it's funny, it's like, it is fine art, but it was also written for not fine people. Like, and so like, having people be able to listen to a translation, I think, is like a great access point for everybody.
Do you have your heart set on any particular role? Do you want to go back and do more of Juliet? Do you have another Shakespearean character that's calling to you?
Yeah, I would love to do more. I love it. It's like a delicious meal. Like, it's so fun to do. I'd like to do a villain next. I'm not sure what. I'd like to do something duplicitous. Like, you know, you don't think necessarily that. But I would love to do that. Caesar comes to mind, characters in Caesar. I would love to do Juliet again. I know I'm getting a little old, but but you know.
Not on audio.
Yeah, that's good to know. Yeah, I would love to. It feels endless. Obviously, yeah. Hamlet is something up there too. As I've said, you can't play Hamlet until you've played Hamlet. So that's up there too.
But first you have to get through Broadway and all your
Gotta do
Broadway
that
gigs.
first.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Dorcas Lung. I really cannot thank you enough for the beautiful work that you did on this podcast series and for all of the time you've shared with us today. It's been a real privilege.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me. This is fun.
Listeners, you can now reach me directly by email. Yes, it's happened. I have succumbed. I am opening myself to communicating with our audience, and I am happy to get your emails. Any comments, questions, suggestions, reactions to any of the work we're doing at Next Chapter Podcasts or the Play On Podcast in particular, I will be happy to read your comments and I will be happy to reply. My email address for audience inquiries and comments is michael@ncpodcasts.com. Michael, MICHAEL at N as in next, C as in chapter, podcasts with an S at the end.com. You've been listening to the Play On Podcast bonus content series. You can learn more about the Play On Podcast at Next Chapter Podcast website, ncpodcast.com, where you can find other Play On podcast series and interviews, along with talk podcasts like The 500, Indecent with Kiki Anderson, Beef with Bridget Todd, and a whole lot more. I'd like to thank Jeremiah Tittle, the founder of Next Chapter Podcasts, and my producer, Pete Musto. Our audio engineer, editor, and sound designer is Justin Cortese. Be sure to subscribe to Next Chapter Podcast for updates on all the latest content. And don't forget to rate and review our shows. It really helps. I'm Michael Goodfriend, and I look forward to sharing more incredible works in the Play On Podcast series with you, along with lots of enlightening bonus content at Next Chapter Podcasts.
Next Chapter Podcasts.